Coming up on Path to Zero.
When we're talking about decarbonizing port operations, we need to make sure we're doing it in a way that doesn't harm the American economy, that doesn't affect adversely the efficiency of ports.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in for another edition of Path to Zero. You know, we have a bias here towards the wide path here at Path to Zero, and today we have a guest who represents yet another dimension of the journey to a low-carbon future. Just a bit of background before I introduce him. If you are not next to the coast, you might not think much about the subject, but the world's seaports are at the center of the energy transition. Ports move 90% of the world's traded cargo. More than 2.2 trillion tons of freight moves through the U.S. ports each year, and our nation's ports are poised to build nearly $50 billion in green infrastructure over the next decade. To talk more about ports, our guest is Ian Gansler, who is heading up a bold new program for the American Association of Port Authorities to meet the twin challenges of energy security and climate change. The initiative is called Port Opportunities with Energy Resilience and Sustainability, which is known as the POWERS program. The association's 80-plus port authority members are advocating for policies that include promoting energy security, coastal resilience, electrification technology, and next-generation fuels for maritime shipping. Ian Gansler is the Manager of Energy Resilience and Sustainability Policy for the AAPA. It's a big title for a big initiative. Thanks for being our guest on Path to Zero, Ian. It's great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me, Tucker. Looking forward to the conversation.
Well, let's start out by giving the listeners maybe an overview of the POWERS program, perhaps teach them a little bit about AAPA and who makes up that organization. Just tell them a little bit about all of that, please.
Sure. Thanks so much. So like you said, my name's Ian Gansler. I'm with AAPA, or the American Association of Port Authorities, and we are the National Trade Association for America's port industry. We have 80-plus seaports across the country as our core membership. Those are ports on the East Coast, West Coast, Gulf Coast, Great Lakes, inland rivers, Alaska and Hawaii, and some U.S. territories as well. And our association's goal is really to advocate for the interests of port authorities. And by way of that, the interests of every American manufacturer, consumer, and citizen. Ports move $2.2 trillion in freight every year. And that freight movement supports $5.4 trillion in economic activity, which is 26% of US GDP. So we're advocating for seaports, which is really a critical industry for every American. Now, what we've done with the POWERS program, which stands for Port Opportunities with Energy Resilience and Sustainability, is recognize that this is an industry that moves a lot of energy products and consumes a lot of energy. And as the whole country and the world really starts to think about, you know, how can we be better stewards of our environment? How can we ensure that every American industry and homeowner has the energy they need to power their business and their homes? The place to start those conversations is at ports, because it's such a critical industry. And I'm really looking forward to diving into that and getting into all of that entails.
Yeah, a couple of things. Let's back up, because generally when people think about ports, they think about seaports. And I think most of your members have access to some water, right? You really don't represent a lot of inland ports, true?
That's right. We do have a couple of inland ports that are, you could say, landlocked ports, which do play a big role in freight movement. But yes, the vast majority of our members are either on a river, a channel, or on the ocean.
And ports, at least my experience has been, ports are almost like a mini city, if you will. The Port Authority, the one you represent, they kind of sit at the top of the food chain, but there are many companies usually operating in a port, right? Someone perhaps moving the freight in and out, ships, shipping companies that come in with the ships, container companies that start, kind of walk through the hierarchy in a typical port, if you will.
That's a great question. Most ports are a public-private partnership where there is a public port authority that has been established by a state or a local government usually. And that really reflects the fact that our ports are public assets. You know, they are bodies of water more often than not that the public should get benefit from. And the public port authority, in most cases, is a landlord and will rent out property on the port complex to private companies. And those companies are often called marine terminal operators. And those companies will handle the day-to-day operation of a terminal. They will unload a cargo ship and load the cargo onto a rail car or a truck. So there are private companies, you know, that have a big stake in operating ports and paying for a lot of the infrastructure upgrades. And as you said, there are carriers that move the, you know, marine vessels, that move trucks, that move trains in and out of port complexes. And there are more companies, you know, that handle other services, repairing equipment, constructing new equipment on a port complex, not to mention the labor groups that unload ships and load up trucks and trains as well. So these are complex sites where there are a number of stakeholders, public and private, involved.
Yeah, thanks for explaining that. I know, you know, you are in and out of ports often, and so it becomes common to you. But I know I'm shocked when I enter a port. I just look at the variety of different tasks going on: railroads coming in and out, trucking companies in and out, shipping companies in and out. You know, forklifts, material handling, everywhere, storage, logistics. I would say, you know, last Christmas, not the holidays of 22, but, you know, in 21, we read a lot about supply chain difficulties as it related to the ports, but I don't really recall hearing anything this year about logistics jams in the ports. You want to talk about that just for a second?
Sure. And you're right. You know, a lot of listeners are probably thinking, they probably saw pictures of ships at anchor outside port complexes waiting for a turn to dock. And the main reason, there were many reasons for that, but the main cause was during the height of the coronavirus pandemic, people spent less money on travel and on entertainment, on, you know, going to sports games, going to bars and restaurants, and they spent more money on goods that they had shipped to their homes. So there was a flood of exercise equipment, furniture, gaming consoles, home improvement equipment that was imported at volumes we'd never seen before. So all of a sudden, we were importing more goods than the United States has ever had. And that caused some congestion, not just at US ports, but at ports abroad and at rail yards in the US, at truck depots as well. That congestion lasted for a while, and it hasn't disappeared entirely, but it has decreased drastically. The biggest port complex in the country, which is outside of Los Angeles, has almost entirely eliminated its backlog. At one point, there were over 100 ships waiting to dock there. There are now, last I checked, zero. So there is still some congestion, not just at ports, but at other nodes in the supply chain, but it has largely been unwound.
Well, congratulations. I know I often say we're intimately aware of the supply chain. Most people, I think, don't think about it. They order on Amazon, and when their doorbell rings 4 hours later, they don't really think about everything that happened in between. But those of us who work in this, and to see, you know, kind of the improvements that happened from 21 to 22 was amazing. All right, let's go to kind of the ports and climate. Tell me how you think climate change is impacting ports, and maybe even overall how ports are trying to improve their operations through beneficial climate work?
Sure. There's kind of two angles, two answers to that question. There's how ports affect climate change and how climate change affects ports. Obviously, when we're talking about ocean-going vessels, harbor craft, trucks, trains, these are heavy-duty vehicles that use a lot of fuel. The fact that they all meet at a port complex, which we can call a multimodal location, where different modes of transportation meet, mean we can leverage these economies of scale and these kind of new fuels, new alternative fuels to power heavy-duty machinery can be used across modes of transportation. So that's why we think ports are a great place to really invest in this new technology, because it could be used in different modes of transportation. Of course, as climate change, you know, develops, ports are increasingly threatened by rising sea levels, of course. Ports are on the water. They will be the first to be affected by rising seas. But stronger storms, hurricanes, as they're getting stronger, high winds have the potential to really disrupt operations. What people might not think about as much is how heat waves affect the transportation industry. Especially as transportation and ports use more electricity, you're reliant on the electric grid. And when there's a heat wave and everybody in the country or a region turns on their air conditioner at the same time, the power grid becomes stressed. And locations like a port that use a lot of electricity find themselves having to ration that energy. And whenever you have a port that is moving goods for an entire region having to use less energy, that means you're moving less goods. So we need to make sure that ports can stay operational even in the face of these environmental challenges.
And again, as one who's kind of been to Long Beach quite a bit, you know, been to a lot of the ports, I'm always amazed at the residential density usually around the port. And, you know, in my own work, I think often about the quality of air impacting not only the people in the port, but the people who live around the port, many times of which those who are least able to make a change. And so to me, a port is a perfect example of how we need to decarbonize rapidly, but pay attention to the cost, pay attention to the reliability. And when we do it and we do it right, we not only benefit kind of society as a whole, we directly benefit the people that we often talk about as those who are least able to move. And so it's a great challenge, and one I'm so proud to see that, you know, y'all are tackling head on. You know, when you talk about the Powers program, you use an interesting term. You advocate for pragmatic decarbonization. Tell us what that means.
That's right. You know, like we were just talking about, every American experienced this. When ports were congested over the last few years, it affected the economy. It contributed to inflation. It caused manufacturers to not have the parts they need, retailers to not be able to stock their shelves, restaurants to not get maybe some of the food they wanted to serve. When we're talking about decarbonizing port operations, we need to make sure we're doing it in a way that doesn't harm the American economy, that doesn't affect adversely the efficiency of ports. That doesn't mean ports aren't going to address climate change or start mitigating their emissions, but these public port authorities with limited budgets are telling us they can't reduce their emissions 100% in the next 12 months. But that doesn't mean they can't start doing it right now. There's a lot of solutions that can be implemented today, but a lot of them are very expensive, and these public authorities do need some government support to get started.
Well, and to that end, you have worked hard with the last two funding rounds, infrastructure law and then the Inflation Reduction Act. I believe you have gotten over $3 billion, and that may be a bit understated. So at least $3 billion in grants that are aimed at ports, generally around emissions. Tell us kind of how ports you think will put that funding to work.
That's right. And you are right in that the number is a little bit higher than that. In the bipartisan infrastructure law, passed by Congress last year, there was just over $5 billion that's exclusively available for port authorities. That's split between the Port Infrastructure Development Program, which is a grant program available for freight movement at ports, and funding for the Army Corps of Engineers, which is a federal agency that maintains the federal navigation channels, the harbors and the rivers that ships use to get in and out of our ports. In addition to that, the Inflation Reduction Act had $3 billion for an entirely new grant program to reduce air pollution at ports. So that program is being essentially drafted as we speak. AAPA will be submitting a comment to the EPA, advising them on how we think that program can be best designed to benefit port authorities and the public in the coming weeks. So that we're really excited about that grant program. It's a first of its kind program that will give port authorities some of the resources they need to purchase this equipment.
Ian, we're going to take a short break and then we'll be back.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane. Energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com.
Welcome back to Path to Zero. We're talking to Ian Gansler, who's leading a new energy security and climate change initiative for the more than 80 port authorities in the U.S. And in a port today, the huge cranes that people usually associate with unloading a ship, they're almost always electric, right? I mean, that's kind of the standard fuel.
That's right.
For those. But then the rest of the port is generally a mixture of trucks and forklifts and trains, so probably intensely diesel, I guess, generally, diesel or gasoline.
That's right. The largest cranes that you would see are called ship-to-shore cranes, and those generally are electric already. But there are a dozen other types of cargo handling equipment that a port would use. Some are called gantry cranes or top pickers, forklifts, drayage trucks, and many of these types of equipment do run on diesel. There are electric alternatives. There are hybrid gas electric alternatives. There are propane alternatives. But when implementing these alternatives, you have to have a supply line for gas or propane. You have to have transmission lines and charging stations for electricity. So whenever you're replacing a diesel-powered vehicle with an alternative, there's a lot of considerations that go into that.
You know, we have worked closely with lots of that equipment in there, but I guess your mix, as you think about it, and now you have really a war chest to put to work. I know you think about electric infrastructure, but you would also think about fuels like propane, natural gas, and hydrogen. Did I really miss anything in that suite of alternative fuels?
There are a few more. I think biofuels definitely have a role to play. It remains to be seen how exactly this mix of alternative fuels will play into the future of transportation and of port authorities. You mentioned a few of them. Methanol and ammonia are two alternatives also being considered, especially for ocean-going vessels, whereas land-based equipment can more easily run on electricity because it's a smaller vehicle. You can plug it in when you're done. A ship that will be at sea for days or weeks at a time can't run on battery because it's too large and there's no charging stations in the ocean. So some of these fuels like hydrogen, ammonia, or methanol, or biofuels are seen as promising alternatives to power some of the ships of the future.
And I am proud to say as well, I've been a part of it for the last 7 years, I think, but we now have 45 ships around the world running on propane.
Sure.
And another 150 or so in construction. So we really expect at the end of this cycle to have something over 200 ships operating on propane, which has been interesting to see. That's been a fuel of choice. I read a lot about what AAPA is doing and read a lot about the Powers program as we prep for, you know, a meeting coming up with you. But you seem to be more interested in energy security than most. Tell us about why energy security has been so critical to the Powers program.
Well, there's kind of two aspects to energy security. The first, I would say, is international. We all know what's been going on in Ukraine with Russia's invasion and how, of course, primarily that's affected the Ukrainian people. But the secondary effects of that have been countries severing their supply lines from Russian energy, especially in Europe. These countries are facing a difficult winter right now where energy prices are skyrocketing and their supplies of energy are dwindling. In the United States, we are exporting more energy, including liquid natural gas and other petroleum products, than we ever have before. And our allies in Europe are really counting on those energy supplies to get them through the winter and to keep their economies going. So while we need to be mindful of, you know, the effects on climate change, we also can't leave our allies out in the cold. So that's one aspect where we're trying to support our port authorities that are exporting this energy and making sure they have the resources and the infrastructure to do that in even greater quantities. The second aspect is here at home in America. And like I mentioned earlier, you know, when you start to electrify more equipment and you're more reliant on the electric grid, you make yourself more vulnerable to extreme weather events. When there is a heat wave that starts to, you know, force a utility to ration electricity, or an intense cold weather event that does the same when people start to turn on their heat and energy supplies are short. Ports and other industrial centers can find themselves without the energy they need to keep goods moving. So we want to make sure port authorities have the energy they need to keep operations going 365 days a year. And when there is an interruption in power, whether it's electricity or another fuel, there's a backup system in place to make sure, you know, the power stays on.
Well, I want to commend you. I mean, I think you just described pragmatic decarbonization perfectly, because it has to be available. It has to be affordable in your case, because we all pay the price if your energy skyrockets. Frankly, I think we all benefit when you make responsible choices. So it's truly wonderful to hear, you know, how the ports and the port authorities are thinking about this. You know, the last thing is studying for you a little bit. I see that ports more and more seem to be engaging in the conversation around offshore wind. What role does AAPA play there?
Sure. Offshore wind is a really nascent industry. There's one commercial offshore wind farm in the United States right now, off the coast of Rhode Island, at a pretty small scale. But it's also an area of massive opportunity. We have obviously very lengthy coastlines in the United States and very windy waters. There's a huge potential to produce massive amounts of zero emission electricity off of our coasts, and rather cheap electricity compared to some other sources. But we're starting basically from scratch right now. In Europe especially, offshore wind is a really mature industry, providing a really sizable portion of their power sources. But it took them years to get to that point. The way ports factor in to the offshore wind industry is really comes down to the size of these turbines. I'm sure many listeners have probably seen wind turbines as they're driving along highways, you know, out in countrysides. the offshore wind turbines are even larger than land-based turbines. These components are so large, they can't move by truck and they can't move by rail. They can only move on a ship by water. That means you have to construct offshore wind turbines on the water. You have to marshal them on the water so that an installation vessel can come pick them up. What that means is you need a manufacturing plant at a port, and then you need to move all the components from manufacturing plants to a secondary port where all the components will either be laid down, ready to be picked up, or they'll be partially assembled on the water. And then a specialized vessel called an installation vessel will come pick them up, bring them out to the site where they will be installed, and essentially stick them down into the, you know, into the bedrock of the ocean floor. In the United States, we have one marshalling port right now, and that's in New Bedford, Massachusetts. To increase the offshore wind industry to a point where it's making a difference for the everyday American, we will need several more marshalling ports, several manufacturing ports around the country right now. So it's a big lift. We don't have the land we need right now. We don't have the capital to construct these facilities. And we don't have the vessels to install the turbines. But the benefits are massive. If we can get the public support we need to make these improvements, it could mean, you know, thousands and thousands of jobs in any state that gets involved in this industry. It could mean, you know, massive amounts of clean electricity and cheap electricity for Americans up and down coastlines across the country.
Yeah, great, great summary of that. And I was interested to see how involved you are in that. Okay, we're going to have a little fun now. We love to have a little magic. We give you a magic wand and you can use it to change one thing in the next year regarding your field of interest, hopefully ports and transportation. So use your magic wand to change one thing in the next year that would benefit, if you would, climate change. How would you use that wand?
Interesting. I would say, as when it comes to port authorities, if I could wave a magic wand and guarantee unlimited electric supplies to port authorities, that would make a huge difference. If a port authority could just count on unlimited clean electricity, that would allow a massive expansion of the use of electric equipment and hybrid equipment at ports. And it would allow ports to really accelerate the generation of alternative fuels. And we mentioned previously the use of hydrogen and other alternative fuels for vessels at sea. To produce those fuels in a low or zero emission way, you need electricity for a process called electrolysis to produce hydrogen and to use hydrogen to make other fuels. So getting enough electricity to make a significant amount of those fuels is going to be a big challenge. So if I could wave a magic wand, unlimited electricity would mean we could make big steps in the alternative fuel space, electric and hybrid cargo handling equipment, and make sure in the event of an extreme weather event, you know, ports don't go offline.
You know, to that, it's a great use of your wand, and I appreciate the answer. Let me just ask, as we kind of often think a lot about drayage trucks, because drayage trucks are clearly a big part of the problem. So improving them would be a big part of the solution. You know, for those of you who don't really follow in a port, historically, drayage trucks will pick up the container and they may move it a couple miles, or frankly, they may move it 500 miles, depending on kind of where the port is and kind of the terms of drayage. But historically, these are a lot of the older pieces of equipment, generally not as clean as modern equipment, and very cost driven. So of all the technologies in the port, the one area that I have not come up with a very strong solution is the drayage truck, because to move them to an electric vehicle is probably going to be prohibitively expensive. I don't think consumers of America are prepared to pay for the increases in transportation costs for that. One solution we tend to work on would be, in fact, a hybrid vehicle. In our case, propane hybrid, but there could be, or renewable propane hybrid. But are you aware of anything that's going on, you know, a concerted effort around drayage trucks right now to move them to a cleaner fuel that's other than the conversation around moving them to electrification? But I don't think that's a realistic conversation, probably given cost.
Sure. It's a really important question, both for reducing carbon emissions, but also reducing what are called criteria pollutants, which are the, you know, forms of pollution that are harmful, like you mentioned before, to local populations, people breathing in the air around a port complex. When you see that black smoke spewing out of a truck's tailpipe, that's what we want to reduce. And while an electric drayage truck can reduce carbon and particulate emissions and criteria pollutants, a hybrid drayage truck, you know, using natural gas or propane, as you said, can really dramatically reduce those criteria pollutants. And I think it could be a big benefit to, you know, communities living nearby these industrial locations, living nearby port authorities, is taking advantage of the tremendous criteria pollutant benefits you can yield by switching to hybrid vehicles. So there are a lot of port authorities around the country that have specific programs for this, using public funds to help truck drivers purchase cleaner alternatives. And the reason it's kind of organized at the local level in that way is the vast majority of truck drivers are small businesses. Oftentimes a truck driver will own his or her own truck. They might own two or three trucks and have a small business that way. So it's difficult for a truck driver to purchase a new vehicle when it might cost two or three times the price of a diesel traditional vehicle. So a lot of port authorities are setting up funds to subsidize the purchase of either electric or propane or natural gas powered vehicles. And I think that's a good model that a lot of ports are looking for, and certainly one that could use some more financial support from the federal government to help make that transition.
Yeah, that's an area we're really excited to be working on. Let me just ask, anything else we haven't talked about you'd like our listeners to know, or anything else you want to say about your work at APA or the Powers Program?
I would just note to the listeners, if you want to learn more about the work AAPA is doing, you can go to aapapowers.com to learn about our energy and environment program. If you want to, you know, get even more involved, we have several events throughout the year, both in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere. Our next event will be our legislative summit, which will be March 27 to 29 in Washington, D.C. And that'll be an event focused on policy here in the nation's capital. You can go to aapa-ports.org to learn more about those events. And please follow us on Twitter at Ports United.
That's awesome. We'll love having you. Look, we want to thank you for kind of being our guest today. And we have a fun way of doing that. We've created a virtual national forest. We call it the Propane National Forest, but we'll plant a tree in a national forest in your honor. So is there a spot somewhere you enjoy going that we could plant a tree in your name?
That's great. That's a great little tradition you have. Well, I grew up going to summer camp in the Poconos in Pennsylvania. So that's a region very special to me, the natural beauty of Pennsylvania. So I think I would go with the forest in Pennsylvania.
Well, we will be happy to find a national forest there and plant a tree in your name. Loved having you today. Thank you so much for being our guest today on Path to Zero.
Thanks so much, Tucker. This was a great, great conversation.
Well, that wraps up this episode of Path to Zero. And a quick reminder, if you want to send me a note to comment on an episode or give us a new topic to consider, just shoot an email. The address is path2zero@propane.com. You can always connect with me on LinkedIn. I look forward to hearing from you. See you next time on Path to Zero.
Thank you for listening to Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to path2zero@propane.com.